You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
All across Wisconsin from Civic Media, this is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Good morning. Welcome back to Up North News Radio, brought to you by Courier Newsroom and carried by our friends here on the Civic Media Radio Network at 7:06 on a Thursday morning, January 30th, 2025. Coming up this hour, we will talk to two rookies in the Wisconsin legislature, though not rookies in the baby-faced way. Randy Udell and Jamie Wall have been around Wisconsin politics for a while, but have stepped up and decided to engage in some firsthand public service with seats in the Assembly and State Senate. So we will talk to them right around 7:30 or so. We'll also talk about, big government. What's your definition of big government? Would it be government like dictating the minutiae of your lessons, even if those lessons are, say, lacking in substance? Well, that would be what Donald Trump wants to do to public schools in Wisconsin and across the country. Meanwhile, Wisconsin legislators, their answer for schools is to put more guns in classrooms. Tell you about all that coming up in just a little bit. Along the way, if you'd like to get us a message, 855-75-CIVIC, you can text us at that number, or you can use the Civic Media app, or you can put a comment on Facebook or YouTube, just as Rob in Tigerton does every morning, in which here he says, good morning from Tigerton. It's clear and 20 degrees. It's very dry. I don't ever remember being this dry in January. There have been plenty of grass fires, especially in the Green Bay area. Meteorologist Brittany Merlot is with us now. Brittany, it is dry.
Yes, it is. You can feel your lips cracking, your face cracking. I mean, the dew points are extremely low, and we are definitely in that winter weather. I mean, winter's pretty dry typically when we lack that humidity, but those winds are going to be changing things as we go through the afternoon, and we're actually going to be feeling like spring today, going down in history in a lot of parts of the state for record highs. We're looking at beautiful sunny skies and a system swiping towards northern Illinois, and as it does so, it's going to lift in that nice warm air where our highs are going to be in the mid-40s to mid-50s. So this is unusual. This is extremely warm. Our records are right now anywhere from the low 40s to the low 50s. So a lot of places will be breaking this. And then after that, we are going to be cooler for tomorrow. Temperatures slide about 10 degrees cooler. And then snow pushes in as we go into Saturday, where we are looking at about 1 to 3 inches for the northern part of the state and about a trace to a half an inch south. And then a wintry mix moves in on Sunday. So a wild, very active weekend after a nice warm up today.
It kind of feels like today is like something out. What's the Christmas special? The Year Without a Santa Claus. Is that the one with the heat miser? that they got their wish for one day of record warmth, 50s in January.
That's it. Yeah.
Whatever gets it done. Luke's filling in for Greg here, and we were talking in the last hour about beer can chicken and Pringles coming out with beer can chicken flavored potato chips, including Miller Lite as the beer can that you make the chicken on. Your reaction tells me you are not a griller. You don't have a beer can chicken recipe that you can share with us or anything like that?
No, okay. I don't. So I'm going to have to try these Pringles.
This is going to make the Civic Media tailgate at American Family Field that much more of a challenge.
Well, I feel like we got to do it today. Like, I got to go out and bust out the grill. It's going to be in the 50s almost. I feel like when we had a warm, was it last Friday? I don't know. Time's really weird. There was a recent Friday that was really warm. I just broke out the grill because I was like, you know what? It's in the 40s in January. Yeah. I'm going to grill some burgers. So Kelsey and I had burgers for dinner.
It'll be in the 50s in places where then it's required. You have to go out and grill.
Absolutely.
So if any of you are listening, you work in the meat department of a grocery store or your own meat market, you better make a few more patties and cut a few more steaks today. Folks are going to be stopping in spontaneously saying, let's get this done. They are. Brittany, thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. Coming up across the Civic Media Radio Network, well, let's see, for Matt Nair on Air, Jane is joined by Angela Lang, who will co-host, filling in for Mr. Greg Bach today. The Earl Ingram Show includes a visit with Judge Susan Crawford, candidate for Wisconsin Supreme Court. That'll be during the 9 o'clock hour. Those of you listening in Wausau on 98.9 WXCO, you get an extra hour of me. As Chad is a little under the weather, his voice has gone kaput once again. So I'll be filling in for the first hour of the Chad Holmes program today. And, of course, you can always learn much more about what's happening on all the stations and shows by heading to their website, civicmedia.us. You can learn what we're doing at Up North News by heading over to upnorthnewswi.com, and you can sign up for our newsletter while you're there. Among the stories in today's newsletter, one about how the Wisconsin Department of Health Services is reporting significant increases in flu, COVID-19, and RSV, respiratory virus. Emergency departments are seeing a surge in respiratory cases, especially among vulnerable populations, infants, young children, and older adults. You want to stay out of the ER? Get your flu shot. Get your COVID shot. But a lot of you have put that off or aren't doing it because, according to DHS, 31% of Wisconsin residents have gotten a flu shot this season. 31% with a flu shot, and a mere 15% are up to date on their COVID-19 vaccines. So keep yourself out of the hospital. Don't take these things for granted, and go get your shots. Let's get a little sports here at 7-12 right now. The Badger men's basketball team, 17th ranked in the country, but they lost to Maryland last night, 76-68. The Badgers have now lost 2 of 3 following a 7-game winning streak. The Badger men have a 16-5 record overall, 6-4 in the Big Ten. They will next play Saturday afternoon at Northwestern. You can catch that game on several Civic Media radio stations and on the Civic Media app. So go over to civicmedia.us to learn more. The Badger men's hockey team is playing Friday and Saturday against the Minnesota Gophers. You can hear that on WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids starting at 6:30 on Friday, 4:30 on Saturday, and on the app as well. The Marquette men's basketball team ranked 9th in the country. They defeated Butler on Tuesday night. They next play Saturday night at home. They will host 25th ranked Cincinnati. The Badger women's hockey team ranked number 1 in the country. They will be at Minnesota Duluth Friday evening and Saturday afternoon. And finally, the Milwaukee Bucks will be in San Antonio tomorrow, and then they will be home Sunday against Memphis. All right, there is a story I wanted to tell you about. Well, actually, multiple stories about our schools and public schools, the need to, defend them from all manner of attacks, financial, ideological, you name it. On Wednesday evening, President Trump signed 2 executive orders that target public schools. One would prevent schools from recognizing transgender identities. It would prevent schools from teaching about concepts like structural racism, white privilege, unconscious bias, and threatening their federal funding if they do so, all the while emphasizing what Trump calls a patriotic education, which also means not teaching parts of American history to American children. Another order would prioritize federal funding for private voucher schools. Again, your tax dollars going toward private, usually religious schools, often for families who have already been able to afford the vouchers, but now you will pay for a private education. Trump and others, they tend to cite lower test scores in public schools as a reason for wanting to move resources. They conveniently forget to remind folks that they're the ones who have made public schools suffer through what is now decades of underfunding. And that's by design. Private religious schools, they are not better academically by any measurable standard. Time and time and time again, this has been proven. They're not worse. They're not better. They're different. They're a second school system Can Wisconsin taxpayers afford two systems funded by your dollars? But private schools can do more picking and choosing of who they accept and who they exclude, what you can teach and what they don't teach. Some might call it indoctrination. But regardless, it sounds a lot like big government to me when big government is dictating that you must teach patriotism, but you cannot teach the things that have made our country what it is, including our struggles, including our missteps on our way always toward becoming a more perfect union. So what are Wisconsin lawmakers doing about this? Well, Republicans control the Senate and Assembly and have shown no indication that they're going to make up the shortfall in funding our public schools. So what are they proposing? Well, let's see. For one group of lawmakers, it's about requiring public schools to display a sign that says, "In God We Trust." Put that on the walls of the classrooms. The three legislators who are putting the bill out there want all public school buildings to have that sign up on 11 by 14 paper by the 2026-2027 school year. That's their answer. Look, it could be worse, and it is. Here's another Republican bill that's been introduced that says we need more armed teachers. We need more loaded guns in classrooms. And also provide grants to schools to improve building safety and staff training. So a lot of money for, I don't know, metal detectors and putting police officers in schools and all kinds of things, because that's easier for a politician than actually doing something about America's gun crisis overall. So arming the teachers is the way it would be done. In both cases, the "In God We Trust" sign on the classrooms and the arming teachers both are sponsored in part by Senator Corey Tomchek of Mosinee. This second bill would allow teachers with a gun license to carry firearms on campus if school boards adopt a policy saying that it's allowed. I don't even know where to go on that, because I feel like the best thing I could possibly do to react to this is to say their answer to school shootings is to put more loaded guns into classrooms with people who are not law enforcement officers and do not undergo regular training in our schools. So I guess maybe in God they'll have to trust, because we certainly can't trust some of our lawmakers to keep our kids safe or to give them a properly funded, thorough education. Still ahead, two of our newest state legislators, Representative Randy Udell and State Senator Jamie Wall. Wherever you're listening across Wisconsin, when you're here, you're up north. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Don't know what's happened to me since I met you. Feel like I'm falling.
It's Marty Balin's birthday, well, the late Marty Balin's anniversary of his birth, I guess we should say more properly, from Jefferson Starship and Starship. That's part of today's history lesson coming up in a half hour here on Up North News Radio. Adam can't share any food secrets here, but he does add, love the show, guys. Thanks for what you do to keep us all informed and involved. And I appreciate that comment very much. Thank you, sir. It is eerily quiet at Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C. right now. The airport's scheduled to reopen in about 3.5 hours as operations continue in the Potomac River after a mid-air crash late last night. It happened about 9 o'clock Eastern time when an American Airlines jet, an American Eagle jet, with 60 passengers and 4 crew members aboard coming in from Wichita, Kansas, collided on approach to the runway with an Army helicopter. while landing at the airport. Hundreds of rescuers searched the frigid waters of the Potomac River for any survivors of the crash. Passengers on the jet included figure skaters, coaches, and family members who were returning from a camp held in conjunction with last weekend's U.S. Figure Skating Championships in Wichita. The camp was for top juvenile, intermediate, and novice skaters that always followed the figure skating championships. The Figure Skating Association says they are devastated by this unspeakable tragedy and hold the victims' families close in our heart. The Kremlin has confirmed that Russian figure skaters, as well as other Russian nationals, including two world champions from the 1990s who are now coaches on their team, were aboard the flight. In a post on Truth Social, President Trump openly questioned the tactics of the military helicopter and air traffic controller. These are both agencies that report to him. Writing, quote, "The airplane was on a perfect and routine line of approach for an extended period of time on a clear night," he puts in all capital letters. "Why didn't the helicopter go up or down or turn? Or why didn't the control tower tell the helicopter what to do instead of asking if they saw the plane? What a terrible night this has been. God bless you all." It's the president of the United States. Basically like one of, part of the peanut gallery that gathers behind the police barricades and the police tape, second guessing the investigators while things are still going on. It's not too much to ask, but could you be presidential in times of tragedy? Could you try it once instead of second guessing out loud, especially you're second guessing hardworking air traffic controllers and members of the military, any one of whom might have made a tragic mistake and may have to live forever now, their family, with noting what the president of the United States said online in the aftermath of the crash. It's really something. And it gets me into the story I promised I'd tell you here, where I was in Eau Claire over the weekend and was approached by somebody. They know, you know, I mean, when you're on TV and radio, you're rather approachable. And I was happy to make some small talk. And then the person says, and not in a hostile way, he wasn't saying this in like an overtly political way. He says, "Well, I mean, even if you don't like Trump, you have to admit he makes your job easier as a reporter." And again, I didn't show any flashes of anger or frustration, but I definitely gave him a longer response than maybe he was expecting. I said, "No, it makes my job harder. It makes my job much harder. Though I get what you mean, because Trump is always saying and doing some outrageous thing. And as a result, we don't have a lot of what you would call slow news days, because he does provide lots of what we call content. But as I told him, all that content, all that stuff, the actions and the wrong information, it all has to be put in context. We have to do our damnedest to fact check before we put something he says on air or in a story. And just as important, or more so, we have to be prepared to tell people what it means. It's not enough to just say, well, Trump's thinking out loud about cutting all federal spending. It's like, well, what does that mean? Who does that affect? And that's a lot of homework to do and a lot of people to reach out to. We have to explain the current situation. Maybe it's a program he doesn't like, but is already helping a lot of folks back in Wisconsin. We have to consider the unintended consequences of what Trump is proposing, because maybe he didn't think it through before he opened his mouth. Or worse, he did understand the consequences and he just doesn't care. And we're the ones that had to dig it up and tell people about it. So yes, there are some media folks whose jobs are easier because of Donald Trump. I call them stenographers. They take what he says and they spread it around. And they do so because they know people are going to react to it. Donald Trump gives people a lot to react to, a lot of knee-jerk reactions that hit emotional buttons. Now, some of those stenographers are folks in the right-wing media, and they're doing it intentionally. They love all of this content. They don't necessarily give you any context or perspective. Other stenographers aren't in the right-wing media, they're in what you know you would call the lazy media, the ones who claim not to have a point of view, but also can't make any claim on doing homework. they read the press releases right out loud, or they print the press releases just as is, and they call it news. That's stenography. Donald Trump and his allies are counting on more newsrooms to do that, to not put his words and his actions into perspective. For those of us who do that, life is definitely not easier. And I think the very nice gentleman probably won't ask me any more questions about that if he sees me again. We don't have time now, but I did want to note that we did hear the latest comments from state Supreme Court candidate Brad Schimmel, the former attorney general, who was recorded making comments about the need for, that there may be a need for a bloody revolution in this country to get rid of the socialists who won't give up their money or their power, because the socialists have all the money and power. To which I'd say, what? It's pretty clear to me. Well, first off, if you're using socialist, I already lose some respect for you, because you clearly don't know how to use the word properly. There's no socialist going on around here in this country right now. And in terms of who's got the money and the power, really, I'm thinking it's the people with an estimated combined personal worth of $1 trillion sitting in the front row at Trump's inauguration. But if that's what it takes to motivate you to say that maybe we need a bloody revolution, well, maybe we need to rethink putting you on the state Supreme Court. Joe Specky's up next. You're up north. You got my heart. I don't know what I'm gonna do with you. All right, welcome back to our homeroom segment on Up North News Radio, where we're again visiting with Chris Thiel, legislative specialist for Milwaukee Public Schools. Chris, how are you today?
Doing well, Pat. Thank you.
Good.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you so much for being here for one of today's topics, which centers around voucher schools in Wisconsin, otherwise known as school choice, but is also something having a horrific impact on the funding for our local neighborhood public schools. And look, for all the years that this has been around, Republicans who have controlled the legislature for the past dozen years or so have been a little creative in how to keep taxpayers from fully understanding how much more money year after year after year is going into funding the voucher private school program. There's something that I think a lot of people think might be tried again this session when they do the new state budget. Some people call it decoupling, but terminology notwithstanding, Chris, can you explain what we might want to be looking out for in Madison this year?
The history of voucher expansion in the state of Wisconsin is one where I think it's fair to say, we have been as transparent as we could be when we're talking about what the impact of this will be. And friends of mine know I send out an article, Steve Castell, who is the Republican chair of the Assembly Education Committee back in 2015 or so. And again, this is a Republican chair of the Education Committee, made this point, and he may have been the best one to do it, where he just said, people have been unwilling to do the math and really just kind of talk about what this means. So decoupling, as it's being called, which is kind of frankly just a cute word for the next major leverage point in voucher expansion.
Right. So let's break that down. What, maybe start with how do we kind of see what voucher schools are costing right now versus, what a new paradigm would look like?
So there's a history of this. When this was only a Milwaukee program, it was actually, presented as something that would save taxpayers across the state money, because state aid was taken away from Milwaukee. And we had to increase our property taxes there at one point up to about $55 million of our property tax levy that was hidden in the MPS tax levy was going to pay for vouchers. So that there's been a change since that point. And now that we've had expansion of vouchers statewide, there's been a process where the voucher tax, as it's called, is hidden again now in your local school districts. property tax bill. And so that was not
in other words. So in other words, when you look at your property tax bill, and let's just say in my case, I see a dollar amount for the Chippewa Falls School District. And I think, well, this is how much of my property tax money is going to the Chippewa Falls Public School District. But 100% of that money, you're saying, is not going to the Chippewa Falls Public School District.
That's correct. I mean, if there is a private school in the Chippewa Falls School District that is taking a voucher, then there's a mechanism within there that is complicated to describe. But essentially, your local school district has to levy higher than they otherwise would to fill in a hole for state aid that is being taken away from them. So their options are two. Either one, levy a tax to fill in that hole, and you will not see that on your property tax bill. Or two, cut funding from the Chippewa schools and programming from the students. So what districts have been compelled to do is levy this tax. And now that it's broad enough across the state and the tax amount is getting high enough, we've reached this tension point where you can't pretend, and I think there was a history here of pretending to the point of Steve Castell, people didn't want to do the math, pretending that there wasn't this property tax impact. So now that there's an admission that there is, and there's a desire to change the funding formula, and that's what this decoupling moment is about.
Right. So essentially decoupling voucher school funding from property taxes. Now, many would say, and many Democratic legislators have tried, to just make property tax bills more transparent so that when you see a dollar amount for your local public school district, you also see the part of it that is, in my phrasing, skimmed off the top and sent to private voucher schools, even though you, the taxpayer, think it's going to the public schools. Decoupling, as I understand it, says, let's just forget that whole hiding the ball charade, and let's just fund voucher schools directly out of the general tax fund. Is it? It's more along those lines?
Yeah, it's you know, something called general purpose revenue, which I think if you're kind of a normal human being, you don't know what that is. It's a term for the pot of state money. So the state would 100% fund private schools out of this central fund. Yeah. I mean, there's so much tension when we are compelled to increase our local property tax levy and the community, you know, that's a burden if the state is not paying its fair share. And right now the state is not paying its fair share. And so if you think about it, public schools would love to have that deal where we were 100% funded and we wouldn't have to have your school board set that levy and all the tension that goes with it. So this then for the private schools, the proposal simply is to have 100% of the funding come out of the state. And if you don't go through the process of thinking about what that impact is on at first blush, it might sound good. Well, great. That doesn't have an impact on my local property taxes. But if you take the policy proposals, and this again, if we want to do this, let's just be honest about it and do the math. If you want to 100% fund a universal voucher program in the state of Wisconsin, which is what the proposals are, that means a voucher in every backpack is kind of the nickname. That's about $1.3 billion plus annually of state money.
Whoa, that no longer sounds like a small experimental program in Milwaukee like it was 30 years ago.
Right. And I just want to be clear, if somebody says, Chris, where did you do that math? Everybody's welcome to go look up DPI private school enrollment and then multiply that enrollment by the current voucher amounts. And the stated goal of some of these voucher folks is to have a voucher in every backpack. So that's fine. If that's what you want, let's just do the math. And that's where the $1.3 billion comes from. And of course, we do a biennial budget. So that's $2.6 billion right off the top when you're putting together a state budget. And of course, as you've discussed before, we don't have enough money for special education funding for public schools and other things. So having the full policy discussion with the real math, I think, is the important thing to do.
And that's the thing. It would bring about that transparency to, I believe, help Wisconsin taxpayers understand the degree to which they are now paying for two separate parallel school systems in this state. And that leads us to Steve Castell, who you mentioned, a former Wisconsin legislator. He's not the only former legislator in Wisconsin, Republican, who initially supported the voucher school program. But between folks in Wisconsin, and now we're seeing more frequently folks in other states, Republicans who said, Well, I supported it at a point, but at some point it grew to be this thing that is actually, what, how are they describing it? Like as a danger to the general purpose or revenue of the whole state, right? It's just gotten, it's gotten too big.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, it's, it, there's been a, you know, partisan nature to vouchers in the state of Wisconsin certainly. But I also say there are no vouchers in Texas. And Texas is a red state. And that's because the rural Republicans in Texas have been very concerned about the impact on their local school districts in rural areas. And I think Castell's quote in that article is, you know, if we just expand this without thinking about it, it'll put the rural schools funding problem on steroids, is a term he used. And then, you know, since we've started, we've maybe been overlapped by other states. Florida's voucher cost is now in the $4 billion range. Arizona's is significant. So again, this is, it, I think, it, bottom line, if we're going to have policy discussions, let's lay out what the math looks like and what the cost impact is. And as we're about to do entering another state budget season, if there are different needs in different areas, we should at least be transparent about, you know, what the potential impacts are.
We're not going to say that there's any one system that is perfect for funding public schools and maybe assisting lower income families that would like to attend private schools. But we certainly know and can recognize where there are things that are not necessarily good for the taxpayers or for accountability. And Chris, and we're talking to Chris Steele from the Milwaukee Public School District. Chris, there used to be a lot of talk about the three-legged stool of funding, you know, education in Wisconsin. But if you start funding the voucher schools 100% out of state general purpose funds, it can be a bit of a double-edged sword because, I mean, what the legislature funds, the legislature can defund. And, you know, we see that a lot just in the University of Wisconsin system, where the legislature is playing games with the amount of state funding that's in there. So again, it just seems to me that the multi-prong approach that involves some state general dollars, but also some skin in the game from local property taxpayers, and then maybe what comes in from a federal government, that kind of a mix maybe insulates our funding for education from politics, but rather than putting all the funding eggs in one basket. I think for voucher schools, it might be a case of careful what you wish for.
It could be. It could be. I mean, and some people have argued that, you know, if you see that total dollar amount in one place, then you have an understanding of what it costs. But all these things, to your point, you know, are tied together. We broke the record last year of school districts going to operational referenda. 148 school districts had to ask that question because they needed funding for their students. This spring, from what I'm hearing from the Wisconsin Association of School Business Officials, we already have 59 additional school districts going to an operational referendum because of a lack of funding for schools, even as we have a significant quote-unquote surplus. Hard to get a surplus when you're not funding your schools, but that's what we call it at the state level. So if you're it depends. Are we going to fund our public schools? There is a constitutional obligation to fund kids with disabilities, English learners, students challenged by poverty, and just our students in general. And clearly, something seems to be out of whack with our priorities if so many districts have to go to referendum, which, of course, has an impact on property taxes.
Well, and again, it plays a role essentially of kicking the can. The legislature can say, well, it's those mean old school districts that have to do this from here. So it appears that while, of course, there's a strong advocacy for voucher schools and private schools and public dollars and things like that, there does appear to be an increasing awareness that even among people who have supported voucher programs before, that without some kind of fiscal limits, constraints, responsibility, oversight, whatever you want to call it, you're going to end up with a voucher school system that's actually going to end up too big to possibly succeed with the taxpayers.
Yeah, and it takes me back to that Steve Castell article again. I mean, what Representative Castell said at the time is nobody has explained, and to this day still nobody has explained, how we are going to fund two separate systems. So if we're going to pour additional state money into one system while we're still last in the nation in funding students with disabilities, for example, we better have agreement that you're at least going to stand up and support the public schools in the way that they haven't been. And nobody's explained how we do both things quite yet. So that'll be on the table as we head into the budget.
Yeah, it just, again, just seems odd to talk about a $4 billion surplus when school districts, their state aid hasn't kept up with inflation for some 16 years now, that you might want to attack that underfunding first. As I've said repeatedly on this program, I will concede the point to Republicans that maybe the first thing is to agree on some kind of a tax cut, maybe a property tax cut. But then let's really look at the mechanism with which we're funding public schools and get that right-sized while we have a surplus, so that we don't run into this problem down the road. But I don't know, maybe that kind of long-range fiscal planning is too much to ask for.
Well, I mean, Pat, I do think, I mean, because we're so connected between our property tax and school funding, appropriately funding our schools, increasing funding for students with disabilities actually will have a positive impact on property taxes. You would not have a record-breaking number of school districts going to referendum if they received the 60% reimbursement that the governor's talked about in the past, or the 90% that school advocates are asking for. If you had that level of funding for schools, you wouldn't have to go to referendum, and that would have a positive downstream impact on property taxes as well.
Chris Steele, thank you again for shining a light on where our tax dollars are going and where people are posing those tax dollars go when it comes to funding education. Chris is the legislative specialist for Milwaukee Public Schools. Chris, nice to have you on today. Thank you so much. Hope you have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
We will be back with more right after this. This is Up North News Radio from Chippewa Falls on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
I will tell you, for the record, Luke Mathers was perfect. Hit every drum beat. Perfect. If you ever get, you do air drum contests, you really should. How's your air guitar playing?
My drumming is all right. I think that's what leads into my air drumming ability to be okay.
Okay, well, yeah, that helps if you've actually played drums.
Phil Collins, I think, very very instrumental in my desire though of learning how to play, because. Really? I know you said throughout the 80s, a little early for me for Phil Collins. I had to catch up to speed later. But my introduction to Phil Collins was the movie Tarzan.
Oh, really?
And just like, I believe the entire soundtrack of Tarzan is Phil Collins. Mm. And my dad really liked all of his work in Genesis and as a solo career. And so my dad would watch documentaries. And you'd see the kind of behind the scenes of Tarzan. They do this whole... like deep dive, and you can see his process of watching the animators create the film and then how he came back, watched it, and made the soundtrack to go along with it. And it's a really cool, I forget what the name of the documentary is, but watch that with my dad. And I always love playing the drums, but seeing Phil Collins as somebody that can be behind the drum set and sing at the same time, I'm not gifted in that regard, cannot sing. Like, sure, we'll do so behind the steering wheel from time to time and whatnot with the songs you love.
Do. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. As one tends to do. But mm-hmm. just the skill and talent it takes to both sing and play the drums, is it's insane.
Well, because it's a bit of a cardio workout while you're trying to sing in a balanced way.
Just a bit.
So, yeah. So I totally get that. Let's see. As mentioned, but in case you're joined us a little bit later here, Chad Holmes is a little under the weather. And so those of you listening on 98.9 WXCO, I'll continue with you for another hour here. And then with Greg gone and Luke filling in, Jane Matinair will need some co-hosts. And Angela Lang from Block is going to be Jane's co-host coming up this morning from 10 till noon. On the Earl Ingram Show, coming up next on many of these Civic Media stations, Supreme Court candidate Dane County Judge Susan Crawford is his guest coming up at 9 o'clock. So, I mean, we've got just a, a busy day all across the network, and so much more Luke than we ever thought possible before.
Not as much as yesterday, though, so I'm appreciative of that.
Okay. All right. We got that. We mentioned already a couple of the stories in the Up North News daily newsletter about the importance of getting your flu shot and your COVID shot, for example. But there's also an article in here about the 10 greatest Packers of all time. There's a can of worms.
Wow. Yeah. Those are some fighting words at a bar, because I'm sure that there's some disagreements.
So I'll come back to that. But I know that we were talking earlier about the Miller Lite beer can chicken flavored Pringles potato chips. And coincidentally, one of the stories in our newsletter today from Christina is about we're getting ready for the Super Bowl here. Mm-hmm. And so what are the most popular game day dips in Wisconsin? Now, around the country, the number one pick for dips is buffalo chicken dip, which I absolutely love.
Yeah.
But it's not number one in Wisconsin. Can you guess Wisconsin's number one party dip?
It's got to be like beer cheese or something along those lines.
That's a fair guess. Well, it's taco.
Taco dip. Oh, okay.
People love the taco dip here. You know, cream cheese, sour cream, taco sauce, refried beans, you know. But there's also, like, in Louisiana, the most popular dip is artichoke dip.
Ooh, that's a good one.
My wife makes that all the time. There's chocolate chip cookie dip. That's number one in Oklahoma. South Carolina has a corn dip. Vermont has a hoagie dip. And Virginia loves pizza dip, which I'm guessing we would call pizza fries here. And I love pizza fries so much.
We went to a dip-off once at...
A dip-off?
Yeah, the Wisconsin Brewing, now Lake Louis Brewing, had like a... I don't think it was anything. It was very much potluck style. It was just like, bring some dips that you want to enter into this. And they were like, you could like rank them. And it was last spring. I think they do it once a year. So I'll have to keep... But there's National Dip Day, I believe. Chips and Dip Day. And it's right around there. And it was a very interesting, they had a pumpkin pie dip that I didn't think I was going to like at first, but it was really, really tasty. But I don't know if I can ever have a sweets kind of dessert dip as my favorite dip. I need a little bit more savory in my favorite dip.
I do like a good fruit dip, but to me, that's almost like a different category, you know, if you will. I think Tony actually would come out on top in a contest in Wisconsin, writing in on YouTube from Ashland. Ranch. Just bring a bottle of ranch dressing. You're going to win the dip contest in Wisconsin. I'm pretty confident of that. All right, just really quickly, because it's mentioned in the newsletter, if you want to pick a fight with folks, I'm just, rather than ask you for your Mount Rushmore of Packer players, I'm just going to rattle off Sports Illustrated's top 10 Packers of all time, and you tell me what you think as we go along. Number 10, Reggie White, defensive end. I thought he might rank a little higher.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also going to find out why. There's some names in here that go a little before our time. Bart Starr, number 9.
What? Oh, again, okay.
Thought he'd be up there a little higher, you know, Super Bowl winning quarterback. But there's players that you might have forgotten, looked over. They were before your time, perhaps. Number 8, Willie Davis, defensive end all throughout the 1960s. Number 7 would be Paul Hornung, running back in the 50s and 60s. Number 6, Herb Adderley, cornerback. Throughout the 1960s. And again, this team was knocking out championships left and right in those years before the Super Bowl. Safety, Willie Wood. Again, all throughout the 1960s. Number 4, Forrest Gregg. I only know him as a coach. Forgot that all throughout the 60s, you know, as an offensive tackle. He was one of the best Packers ever. Brett Favre at number 3. Aaron Rodgers at number 2, which leaves us, and you see his name outside the stadium all the time, outside the Don Hudson Center.
Yeah.
Wide receiver Don Hudson from 1935 to 1945. So make your own Mount Rushmore accordingly, and we'll share notes one of these days here. Thank you, Luke. We'll see you tomorrow for a little bit more Up North News Radio. Tomorrow we will have Jennifer Schulze, Mark Jacob, Jim Santel, Kia Vakil, Isabel Soissons, and Dan Schumacher. Up North News comes to you from Courier Newsroom, a pro-democracy news network. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow morning up north.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.